the political side of it, and then there's the real story.
There's a lot to unpack right there. It wasn't quite the interview I thought that was going to be.
There's a reason for it.
This will be officially my favorite podcast I've ever done.
North Carolina's just been a buzz. I invested in a diamond company that makes lab-grown diamonds in North Carolina. Do you still live in North Carolina?
That's a great space. These days, I move around a fair amount. I've got a whole privacy issue and background there when I got attacked a few years ago. But you know, I still have a lot of family in the Carolinas.
Move around, huh? What was the? Tell us about the SWAT attack. I mean, I guess it was it's called a swatting attack. Is that like when they call people and tell them that something's happening at your house?
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, my Twitter presence grew a lot during one of the crypto hype cycles, and I went from being a nobody to having a lot of attention paid to me. And I got some attention from people who decided that they could try to extort me. So they found my home address. They called up my local law enforcement. They said that I had shot some people and was holding people hostage and had explosives, you know, just used all the right words to get, you know, maximum level of response from the police.
And, I already follow you. I know who you are.
Perfect.
Yeah, no, I already follow you. I mean, I can see it right here. I've been following you for a while, and you've been on Twitter about the same time as my original handle on Twitter, which was early days. Mm-hmm. Did you know Jack, or how did you get on Twitter so early?
No, you know, it's the same way I got into Bitcoin and other stuff. It's just I'm a Uber nerd, and so I'm on the Uber nerdy websites, and I see all the new tech that's coming out, and I play around with it. And, you know, these days I would say I'm on Nostr, which is like the new social media that is, it's completely crypto decentralized, you know, no single entity that's controlling it.
Really? Nostr?
Nostr, yeah. Notes and other stuff transmitted by relays. It was actually developed by a Bitcoin developer a year or so ago, and it really started picking up adoption the past couple months.
Wow. Well, I would love for you to tell people about what you do. I mean, obviously, the people that watch my show know that we do a lot of private equity, that we're a Bitcoin miner, that we're coming out with BitNile.com, which is a metaverse platform that's effectively not 100% decentralized. But you don't need to ask Mother May I from Twitter, from the App Store, from Google, from Facebook. It is link-based. It's all in the browser. And it's going to accept eventually every form of crypto I can think of. That's our goal, that we can legally take. But I'm a big Bitcoin advocate. I own Bitcoin myself. I mine Bitcoin. I've been involved with it since 2011. I've had booms and busts with it. So can you give our audience just a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so I have been working in the Bitcoin space for about 8 years, and I've been really doing the same fundamental thing, just with slightly different variations. And that is basically security, is I have been trying to bring the promise of being your own bank to the normal person. You know, it's always been possible to self-custody, to hold your own keys, to be your own bank, you know, and not be beholden to any third parties. That's really the impetus for this entire space. But unfortunately, the vast majority of people who are getting into it, you know, they're just looking at it as an investment. They're not understanding like the security ramifications, with the ideological modification. And as a result, they're buying some on an exchange and leaving it there. And then we see stuff like, you know, FTX blowing up, or way back in the day, Mt. Gox blowing up. It's almost like every year some major third-party custodian blows up and a lot of people lose their money. And I'm trying to save people from that, because it's not necessary to have your money with a third party.
You think people just want to make it too simple for themselves? They just rather be with someone they can say, they can blame if something goes wrong? Because I do remember the Mt. Gox days, and obviously the people that were in Mt. Gox got lucky. They got held up in bankruptcy for such a long period of time that Bitcoin became so much more valuable that it actually ended up being, from what I can tell, a pretty good investment. I actually know people that bought claims from Mt. Gox and got paid pretty well for it. I'm curious as to why do you think people don't want to self-custody? I mean, is it the complexity of not forgetting your passwords? I think for me, because I keep my Bitcoin at Earnity, which is a company we own. Now, they keep it in trust in my name. So there is a level of safety, but it's still with someone else. And then I keep some at Coinbase. And I we've got to tell you, I have fear that I'm going to lose that crypto, that Bitcoin. But then I also have fear that if I put it in my own wallet, I'm going to lose it too.
Yeah, well, you know, this is like the fundamental problem. You know, we're talking about a bearer asset. So you think of it like gold or cash.
Or a bearer bond, yeah.
And anything that can be owned and can be stored can be stolen. So, you know, whether you're holding it yourself, whether you're holding it at a bank or, you know, a crypto custodian or whatever, there's always a way to lose it. And I think there's a number of factors that are, you know, result in a lot of people not taking self-custody. The first one is that you actually have to take action to do that, right? The default is that, you know, people are setting up their accounts on an exchange and they're wiring their money in and they hit buy. And, you know, this is a user experience that is like any other traditional brokerage. So, you know, you buy your thing, you see the charts there, and you just let it sit there. And, you know, with a traditional brokerage, there is no withdraw functionality. That's just not a thing. So, like, people are not used to even having that possibility. So I think a lot of people don't even look into it. And then, of course, if you do look into it, then there's this sort of overwhelming amount of complexity and knowledge that you need to have if you really want to feel confident that you can be your own bank. I mean, there's a reason that banks exist. It's they're specialists. This is the way that, you know, human society has evolved for millennia, is that, you know, specialization of tasks has allowed us to outsource stuff to people so that they can do things more efficiently and effectively than if we do it ourselves.
Yeah, there's a sense of security that maybe if something gets messed up, the big institution will cover you, I guess. Maybe that's the wrong sense of security. I didn't think about that. You're right. There's not really a ready withdrawal feature other than like a debit card at a brokerage firm. You can take your stocks out, but it just doesn't, they don't make it easy. You have to transfer it and it's a ton of paperwork. But I've actually been able to recently trade some Bitcoin with Coinbase and Earnity. And I found Coinbase's platform to be really efficient. They charge you a lot of fees to take out money if you want it quick. But if you just overcome the fee for a second, the speed of this whole thing is pretty amazing now. So are you suggesting that most people just keep their Bitcoin in some, like, how would you suggest they go about doing that?
Yeah, so, you know, it's also a question of what's the level of value that you're dealing with. I think if someone only has a few hundred dollars worth, you know, if it's not a life-changing amount of money, then you probably don't really want to spend much of your time thinking about securing it. If, you know, a catastrophe happens and it's not going to affect your life for the rest of your life, then, you know, I wouldn't worry about it too much. But, you know, once you get into the realm of having, you know, a sizable nest egg, you know, that's going to vary from person to person, whether it's thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, you know, that's when I think self-custody starts to make sense. You know, spend $100 and, you know, you can buy a dedicated hardware device that will protect you from like 95% of the attacks and hackers and stuff in this space. At that point, you know, once you withdraw to your Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card, whatever, there's a lot of good ones out there. Then the primary issue you have to deal with then is just, it's a simple data backup problem of, you know, where is your seed phrase, your key backup, so that, you know, if your house burns down, you don't lose everything. But, you know, what we do at Casa, we're more on the high end, where if you have a life-changing amount of money, if you have an amount that would really hurt you financially to lose, that's when you want to start looking at a solution like what we provide, where you start getting into a multi-key architecture. So we basically put you into a setup such that it's not just a single key, because this is a single point of failure. We architect a setup so that we're really eliminating single points of failure, so that you can't have one mistake, you know, one human error that results in a catastrophe. And the way that we do that is pretty simple. We put keys on different devices in different geographic locations that have, you know, different security properties around them, which basically makes it really, really, really hard to lose enough of them or to have enough of them destroyed or taken by an attacker that you get locked out of your own money.
I'm interested in that idea. Casa, is it casa.com or casa.net, or how do you get a hold of Casa?
You can go to keys.casa, K-E-Y-S.C-A-S-A.
Keys.casa. Okay. So you're suggesting that the normal way now, which is a bunch of different phrases that are your backup to get to your wallet, you have a way of setting up something where that's it, there's more safety than that. If you lose all that, you don't lose everything. Is that effectively what you just said?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, right now, when people take self-custody, the vast majority of them, they're just putting it onto a single key. And so now, you know, if anything happens to that, if you don't back it up, if it gets lost, if the device it's on gets destroyed, there's a, you know, a lot of things that can go wrong. And if something does go wrong and you don't have a backup to recover from, then there's, you know, no one in the world who can get your money back. You know, there is no support line for Bitcoin.
So when you get a little ledger, you know, those little devices that hold your, what happens if that device gets smashed to smithereens? There's still a way to recover from that?
Yeah, if you have backed up that seed phrase. So like when you buy it and you initially set it up, it gives you like 12 or 24 words. And those are literally the keys to the kingdom. You know, it's English words, but they really get turned into a cryptographic key pair. And they tell you, oh, just, you know, write down these words on a piece of paper and put it somewhere safe. And unfortunately, there's an entire mountain of best practices and knowledge hidden under there and things that can go wrong, which, you know, don't really get covered very well by the hardware manufacturers. So, you know, to set up something where you no longer have to worry about a single mistake causing catastrophe requires using a solution that either, you know, you spend a lot of time architecting or that some entity like us has spent a lot of time architecting.
I wonder in the FTX situation and all the others, when you saw these initial listing of coins that were taking place on exchanges and all different kinds of coins, not Bitcoin, but just other types of, I won't use the word other people use for some of these coins, but just say other coins. I wonder, in your opinion, did the whole FTX thing happen because of just greed? I mean, what was the reason why it happened? Because a ton of people put a ton of money into FTX, and a lot of it seemed to be chasing other coins other than Bitcoin. I've actually pointed out in a recent article I wrote that said that effectively he did us a favor because Bitcoin is the standard. It's not been busted. You can't steal it from somebody. It's, no one's ever hacked it. And I'm just curious as your thoughts about why FTX happened, in your opinion.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing about that is that after it was all said and done, we found out, you know, FTX actually didn't have any Bitcoin. You know, the Bitcoin withdrawals, like when things started falling apart, the Bitcoin withdrawals just failed. They had a number of other coins, and they especially had the FTT token, which was the coin that they themselves created out of thin air and were doing all types of leverage trading with. But, you know, the short version is that it was a failure of company controls and traditional financial best practices. Is they created this whole web of interrelated companies, and specifically they had their trading like hedge fund that was basically given a back door with you know, unlimited margin that was, it was using customer funds to trade on. So like there was just, you know, rampant fraud and theft happening under the hood there, and that was all just, you know, accounting. Now, you know, this is why we say, you know, not your keys, not your coins. It's because when you give your money to a third party, whether it's a, you know, crypto exchange or just a traditional bank or whatever financial service, you don't actually know what is happening to the money after that. It's like it's a complete black box. So you have to completely trust what they're doing under the hood. And in this case, they were doing some really shady stuff that ended up blowing up.
Did you think that all that was basically greed-driven? Or was there some other mechanism? Because to see that they didn't really have Bitcoin was kind of mesmerizing to me. Like, I just can't understand why we need to make this so much more complicated.
Yeah, well, you know, I had my skepticism about Sam for a long time, and that was just completely based upon his demeanor, in that, you know, he never seemed to hold any of the ideals of the space. Like, he didn't seem to care about things like censorship resistance or self-custody or whatever. Like, it was clear all along that he was a traitor. He was just motivated to do whatever it took to increase his wealth. And, you know, he had the whole effective altruism narrative around that, which you can believe or not believe. But, you know, the result of that is that, you know, I think that his moral compass was a bit off there, because he felt like he was doing it for the greater good, despite the fact that, you know, he was harming people along the way. And, you know, it felt like, until the very end, he I think, thought that he could dig himself out of that situation.
Got it. Yeah, I think he still thinks he can dig himself out of that situation.
Yeah.
When it was going a certain way, I mean, and they discover $5 billion of new crypto there that you know, that was, I just think about that scenario and think to myself, well, people were putting the money in for a reason. What was the reason, you think, for FTX coin? Like their FTT coin. Like, I'm asking,
yeah,
like,
well,
I'm asking, like, what was in their mind, like, when you get sold that idea? What do you think's taking place at the time? We have the benefit of hindsight, but did you own any FTT coin? Did you yourself?
No, I never used FTX. I've never touched any of those exchange coins. I'm kind of skeptical of all of the exchange tokens myself. But my understanding from the people that I've talked to was that, you know, FTX did have a pretty good interface. Like, for traders, it was pretty good way of executing trades. You know, they had a lot of liquidity. I think they were one of the very few derivatives exchanges, and so that attracted
For sure. Yeah.
a lot of market makers as well. And, you know, the thing that really irks me, though, is that some of the larger players in these, you know, well-respected funds and market makers, like, they knew that there was shady stuff going on at FTX. They probably didn't suspect it was the level of fraud that it was. But when I went around and I've asked, you know, why were you using it if you suspected that it was shady? And the short version is, you know, you got to play the game. And, you know, if they knew their competitors were playing the game on FTX, but they weren't, then, you know, you're missing out on, you know, potential revenue there. So I think there's a bigger story and question around the sort of self-regulation of this space. Because, like we said, we talked about, like, Mt. Gox, it was 2014, many years ago. And there have been a whole slew of major catastrophes and custodian and exchange failures since. And what happens every time? Something major blows up, a lot of people lose a lot of money. And then for the next month or so, we talk about, hey, you know, we should do proof of reserves, or we should implement, you know, some other best practices. And then people get bored and they moved on. And so I think, you know, that's going to continue happening until we get some sort of coalition of major players together to say, you know, we need some standards and say, you know, that we're not going to give these people our business unless we have reason to believe that they're at least doing some basic best practices.
Where do you like to buy your Bitcoin? Where do you buy that?
Well, my favorite exchange for a long time has been Kraken. From a security standpoint, they have been really solid. Now, you know, for traders, they may not like it as much, because I think they don't have quite the diversity of tokens to choose from as some of the other exchanges.
Mm. And when you buy from Kraken, do you have it delivered to one of your own specialty products like Casa?
Yeah, my general go-to is to treat exchanges like public restrooms. You want to get in and get out as quickly as possible.
Wow. Wow. I've never heard anyone say that, but I will not forget it. If you don't mind, I might borrow it, but I will give you credit for it.
You bet.
Tell us about BitGo. I mean, I know who BitGo is. Are you still involved with them at all, or are you completely on your own now?
No, I mean, other than, of course, being a shareholder, I worked on BitGo for about 3 years in the early days when it was targeting helping exchanges and other enterprise custodians. The whole idea was, these exchanges have to run hot wallets. They have to be able to regularly process transactions, which means they have to have their sensitive key material online. And like, this is a security nightmare, for these bearer assets. So BitGo basically was the first to offer enterprise grade multi-signature wallet, idea being that, they would have a key, we would have a key, we'd have a whole bunch of business rules and logic and security mechanisms around, how to co-sign transactions and, just try to reduce more of those single points of failures. And it wasn't perfect, but we certainly upped the bar when it came to, hot wallet security for exchanges. And
are they still providing that? Are they still providing
that? Yeah. Still ongoing. They've added a whole slew of other services in the years since then. And to their credit, we have seen a vast drop off in exchange hot wallet hacks in the recent years. These days, exchange collapses tend to more often be due to just straight up exit scams or fraud rather than a hacker getting into the exchange and draining all the money.
What's your take on the status of the market right now? What's your take on Bitcoin and the overall crypto market? I'm still mining away. We have thousands and thousands, 20 some thousand miners. I think we've made about $150 million investment. So we're pot committed. I still own Bitcoin myself. I'm a massive believer, but I can see how... I'm also a student of the actual market, a student of the stock market. I've been an investor, ran a hedge fund for so many years, and I've seen these boom-bust cycles. And if you look at the bust of FTX, it looks like a bottom to me. It really looked like a bottom, and I actually bought more in December. I thought it looked like a bottom, and I bought, and I've been buying every day. I buy every day. But then, I don't want to be the lone wolf out there. So, what's your thoughts of the current crypto market, and specifically if you could talk about Bitcoin also after you talk about the crypto market itself?
Yeah, these market cycles have been interesting because it seems like each cycle is different. And so I've been looking at a number of statistics over the past several cycles. And the vast majority of the statistics that I saw for activity in the 2017-2018 cycle that I was expecting would essentially repeat in this cycle did not happen at all. And I think that that's for a few reasons. I think this past cycle was more institutional driven than retail driven. And it was also more credit bubble driven than actual just spot volume, buying and holding. And I think that was really, obviously that was the big surprise. And that's what resulted in a lot of these blowups is just so much leverage getting put into the system that it wasn't really clear that that was happening because it was being obfuscated through all of these different large parties lending to each other, once again, on closed books, behind closed doors in these black boxes that you can't actually see. And so eventually, when that all starts to unravel, it happens really quickly. So, where do we go from here? It's clear, we're essentially a year into a good old-fashioned bear market. I do think that the worst is over. It seems like everything is pretty much unraveled at this point. And so the only real question from my perspective is, know, how long does it take for interest to come back? And usually, you know, that can be a year or two, but you never know what might happen at the macro level that might drive more people in. I mean, I certainly would not have expected that a global pandemic would have, you know, driven huge demand for crypto assets, but you never know what might happen next.
Are you Bitcoin central, or are you agnostic in the sense that you believe in other crypto forms of crypto also? Because I've been learning a lot about Chainlink and Algorand and the validation on chain of certain behaviors. And I actually see a use case for it a lot more than I used to. That doesn't mean I want to invest in it necessarily, but I like Bitcoin, and I believe that, you know, since there's only going to be 21 million, I believe in a security. And so from a pure, like, if our asset allocation perspective, I think you got to have Bitcoin. But do you believe in other things other than crypto, other than Bitcoin?
I mean, the short answer is yes. I mean, I'm a technologist, and so I've felt for a long time that, you know, the real empowering aspect of this technology, which is, you know, cryptography plus blockchain plus the game theory of creating the incentives that actually drive these networks, mm-hmm. it means that there will be quite a few of them. And, you know, the cost for creating new ones is incredibly low unless you're doing something very, very novel. But for me, the problem is more one of, you know, limited time and resources. After a decade, I understand Bitcoin very well, and I am, you know, I'm 100% confident that it's not going to be broken or go away. With any of these other things, especially the newer they are, the more complicated they are, the more effort is required to actually understand the system. And that's because, you know, there is more to these systems than just some software or code. It really is about a lot of the game theory incentives, and, you know, not just short term, but also long term. Anyway, if you're investing for, you know, a period of many years, then I would treat a lot of these things similar to like a sort of angel investing mindset. You know, you might put a little bit here or there, but you have to understand that, like, the risk compared to Bitcoin for almost any of these other networks is insanely high.
Right. Right. I guess I'm just fascinated with the validation of, like, we have a gaming model. And it's going to be open and validated on chain, where people can see and test and look at the randomizer and validate the transactions. I think in that regard, I guess it's really advanced new technology where effectively you should be able to check on people's work and not and eliminate. I don't know if you can ever eliminate fraud, but you can eliminate a lot of the bad actors out there. I mean, is that your belief in what blockchain can do?
Yeah. So, you know, what are we really talking about? We're creating these open networks where fundamentally each of these blockchains, each of these protocols, you know, you're creating your own network. You're creating really a new game. And you're defining the rules of that game. So I think a lot of people make mistakes because they may assume that all of these other games that people are creating are somehow competing with Bitcoin. And that's not necessarily the case. You may create a protocol and a network that's trying to do something completely different. Maybe it's not even trying to be like nation state resistant like Bitcoin. You know, maybe it's more of a like consortium or federation of enterprises that's helping facilitate something. So you have to ask the question, you know, what are we trying to accomplish with this technology? What's the security model? You know, just understand what the different attributes are that you're trying to achieve, and does the software and the incentives of the system actually achieve whatever the claim is? Because it's very easy, and this is certainly what happened in 2017, very easy to put a white paper out that makes a lot of egregious claims, but then they don't actually deliver.
I'm told by my producer you try to avoid public appearances. Are you still doing that?
So my main thing with privacy is to, you know, keep my like physical location or home or whatever as secret as possible because I don't want to have a sneak attack happen again. Mm. I do go to conferences and stuff because my security model is that it's unlikely someone is going to come up and physically attack me when I'm in front of 1,000 people. You know, I think that's generally probably okay.
Unlikely, yeah.
Let's
hope not.
You know, that's the thing about my privacy, though. You know, a lot of people sort of retorted when I put out various articles about the extreme privacy measures I put in place. They're like, well, you know, you're still on Twitter. You know, if you really cared about privacy, you would just delete everything. But, you know, as you know, we're public figures. We have built a reputation over many years, and I don't want to just burn down my reputation and no longer be able to use that, to further the causes of what I've been working on for the past 10 years.
Yeah, it makes sense. I'm sure people ask you this all the time. What are your long-term predictions for what happens with Bitcoin price-wise?
My long-term prediction is that it can go to anything, and the main reason for that is that there is no cap on the total amount of fiat that gets printed. You know, there's an infinite amount of money at the Federal Reserve, as the saying goes. So the result is, if there's no ceiling on the Bitcoin price, because there's no ceiling on the amount of dollars and other fiat that's going out.
Well, I've never looked at it that way. Wow. I've always thought there's no ceiling on the number of Bitcoin that'll be produced. There is a ceiling. I mean, excuse me, pardon me, that's the opposite. There's a ceiling of 21 million, and I've looked at it and said, well, how many millionaires are there in the world? And mm-hmm. figured out what would that be, one Bitcoin per millionaire? And the math isn't there. You know, the demand would be parabolic, and then when you transactionalize it a little bit, but that's a good thought. Yeah. There's no ceiling to the amount of Bitcoin that can be bought with fiat currency. So,
yeah, I mean, people ask, you know, is Bitcoin going to be worth $1 million or $10 million or whatever? But you know, I think eventually you get to the point where it doesn't even matter anymore. You know, if the dollar essentially becomes worthless, as many other fiat currencies tend to do, it's really more a question of time. And you know, the dollar has done a very good job of holding its value compared to many other fiat currencies out there, but you know, the history of these currencies over multi-decade time frames tends to not be very good.
The funny part about it is I talk all the time about people think of the dollar today and they don't realize how, based on how long we've been around, how short of a time frame the dollar has been around and what it looked like even 50, 60 years ago when the Bank of Illinois was printing their own dollars, right? When you would print them at local reserves and you'd print them at local banks and they even had their own different forms of dollars. And we think of it as impenetrable, but, and I don't want to say the best of the worst, but it's the best of all the fiat that out there that is... You know, it's backed by bullets, is effectively, right? It's backed by oil production mm-hmm. and bullets. And you further see the dollar strengthen when you see Russia do what it did to its own people and to Ukraine. People go, do I want to own those rubles? Because I can get wiped out in one day, right? I can get my stuff taken away from me. And then you've seen the yen go basically nowhere for 20-something years. I mean, recently it's done some stuff. And so it is the best of what we have in the fiat world. I assume you agree with that, right?
Yeah, though, you know, there are things that are changing, right? It's like, with the level of debt that America has to service, you know, that is also going to the moon, so to speak. So
sure.
there's definitely a question of, is there some inflection point at which that really starts to negatively impact our ability to remain the currency of the world?
Don't you think there's going to be one day where we all, like, every person discovers that they need Bitcoin? Like, because in the realm of digital assets, people say, well, the US dollar is going to be digitized. Well, it kind of already is, right? I mean, I can just use Zelle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not buying the US dollar so it can appreciate, other than if it appreciates against another form of fiat currency. And I'm not buying the US dollar to appreciate against Bitcoin. So is there any other choice? I'm just curious, in your mind, like when I look at all the math, I go, I don't know if there's any other choice. In your mind, is there some other choice other than Bitcoin? I mean, if you think about in terms of you could own hard assets, which is they're denominated in dollars for sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to have a certain amount of innate value if you buy the right hard asset. But what other choice do people have other than to that dollar to be deflated? It costs more money. Aggregate costs go up, but this Bitcoin, where you don't have to pay to service it, you don't have to pay a fee. There's no cost to retain it. When I own a lot of real estate, and it costs me money every month to keep that real estate going. Yeah, you don't really own it because it can get taken away from you. In fact, if I don't pay my HOA fees, they put a lien on my house, right? So effectively, mm-hmm. isn't Bitcoin one of the purest assets out there? But you see Charlie Munger, it's a longer question, but you start Charlie Munger like just jawboning it to death. But is he not just jawboning his own book? Because the reality for him is that some of his business, like World Book Encyclopedia, if you were just the owner of that company, that got eviscerated by technology, right? Microsoft started putting the CD-ROM out and the encyclopedia was on it. No one to buy it anymore. So what am I missing that people don't understand about how this may be the purest form of holding an asset that doesn't cost you anything to service it?
Yeah, you know, Munger and Buffett, they have built impressive empires, you know, by diversifying across many different assets very thoughtfully, and so you know they've managed to avoid catastrophic loss in that way.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about Bitcoin, you know, compared to any other asset, you know, even you know various hard assets and physical things, is that it gives you this level of security that has actually never been possible before. And this all goes back to the multi-key distribution stuff that we do at Casa, which is that you can create a security model for this asset that is stronger than any bank, that is stronger than any vault, that cannot be penetrated by the world's most powerful army, you know, if you architect it correctly, because you're basically eliminating the single point of failure, which includes the ability for some authority to come in and just seize your asset. So you know, from the defensibility perspective, and I'm the security guy, so that's usually the first thing that I look at. That's very interesting. And then you essentially have something that it acts kind of like a hard asset from an investment perspective. And then, like we said, you can secure it more easily and far better than a hard asset. But also, you can teleport it around the world nearly instantaneously without having to ask permission from anyone to do so. So, you know, it's this weird amalgamation of like internet and communication age plus, you know, hard sovereign asset that, you know, I think it's very hard to find that combination in any other asset.
For security purposes, I'd love to talk about how do they get a hold of, is it Keys or Key Casa? Keys with K-E-Y-S?
Keys.casa. Yeah.
Keys.casa. We're going to put that up in the links down below, obviously, with the podcast. Obviously, security is a big deal. I appreciate all the work you're doing. When we leave today and you talk about security, what should we be telling people right now about what they're doing today? Like, I want to like them to hear you clear as day saying, these are the things you should worry about. If you own, say, 2 or 3 Bitcoin, that, you know, that's $20, $30, $40, $70, $100,000 worth of Bitcoin, and you want to protect that, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, you know, it's not something that you can cover in just 1 or 2 sentences, but I do have a very comprehensive website full of resources that they can just go to bitcoin.page, and you know, I've got all of the like wallet and security guides that are set up there. But the short version is, like I said, if you're at that level of sort of intermediate to, you know, medium amount of value that it would hurt to lose, then you only really need to spend $100 or $200 to actually get the sort of the hardware setup that you need. But it's the best practices and the understanding of, you know, how do you actually employ that correctly to make sure that you don't have a single mistake happen that results in catastrophic loss.
So where do people go to listen to other things you talk about? Because I presume you're an educator too. It's the way you talk, the way you hold yourself out. It seems like you're educating people. Where do they go to get educated at?
I have every article and podcast and, you know, any presentation I've ever done is actually on my website at lop.net.
Jameson Lop, I appreciate your time. I know this was this is a little unusual for me because we just talked about security only and I could have proselytized about what I think about Bitcoin, but I'd really like to learn more about your products. So Keys Casa, when a person uses that service, do they pay a fee, like a monthly fee to be part of that? How do they, is it a subscription? How do they use your service?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we are a, you know, annual subscription-based service. We have several different tiers. One is as low as about $10 a month. That's more of the sort of do-it-yourself, you know, we'll give you sort of email support. Our higher level tiers are more in the range of several thousand dollars a year. And what you're really paying for there is concierge class service of having an actual human who specializes in understanding all of the complexities around self-custody, who you can, you know, talk to on the phone or have a video call with, which is, you know, something that's almost unheard of in this space. It's very hard to get, you know, actual human support, you know, especially during bull markets when everybody is trying to figure out, you know, what is going on, how do I use this stuff.
Exchanges are like public restrooms. You want to get in there, use it, and get out as quickly as you can. Jameson Lop, I appreciate your time. That was fun. You're definitely obviously educated in the security space. We will be putting up a lot of stuff about you and obviously our pre-podcast before we play it live. Hopefully everyone can learn something from about security. I feel bad for the people out there that really didn't practice it. And unfortunately, you probably have a generation of people that have gotten burned at FTX and other exchanges that where they've left their crypto there and didn't follow your advice, which I presume you've been giving out for years about why they should be banking themselves. But I'm sure this is a topic that you and I are going to talk about again. And I hope you come back. I appreciate you being understanding about this being settlement day for something for me. But I'm going to check all your stuff out. Obviously, I know BitGo. We custodian at a major institution who's been in the news recently ourselves. So this is a topic that I'm pretty nervous about. I'd love to discuss with you privately. Maybe there's an opportunity for you to look at our protocol because we obviously get a lot of Bitcoin every day from our mining. And to say that I'm not nervous is a lie. I'm incredibly nervous. And but nervousness brings opportunity. Hopefully we can learn from you. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Great to have you, and always happy to talk about our solutions. And, you know, we very well may have something that would work for you too. And we see a number of teams who actually split between having some funds in custody and some in self-custody as sort of a hedge.
Yeah, I think as a public company, we have a different level that our auditor requires us. And the interesting thing about Bitcoin, and I want to say this to you, is that we're having the hardest trouble banking with people. It's really miserable, to be honest with you. We've had so many banks, you know, we're with them and they kick us out later because we Bitcoin mine. It's just really, it makes no sense to me about how you could do some on Coinbase with all these banks, but we can't do it. It's a really, it's still the Wild West, in my opinion. It's still a long ways to go. So I'm sure the services of Casa and the stuff you're doing, consulting, is going to be needed for a long time as Bitcoin gets adopted. But I, like you, believe it's going to be a major adoption. It's going to continue on. And I think it's almost, you know, Greg Foss, a guy I really like, has said it's almost the purest form of asset he's ever seen. This coming from a guy from a credit standpoint. So I'm a big believer, and I'm really thrilled that you were on the show. And hopefully we'll loop back. I'll talk to my producer and see if there's a time where when there's another topic, we can do something together. We have a Bitcoin conference every year. I'd love to invite you to that. And we'll work on that security thing for you. So we'll make sure we have good security at these conferences because a lot of people, I have some haters out there myself. So take care.
Great, thanks.
Be well.
Bye.
You know, I'm going to explain to you real quick. Continue walking. Don't be rolling yet. There's a reason for it.
So I did get that right.